So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
Time to play the game. Time to play the game!
Politics.com, where you can catch up on all the latest going on around Louisville, around the world. We cover it all. While you're at LouisvillePolitics.com, don't forget to join our RSS feed and click on our sponsors links. Yes, I know that's kind of a pain in the butt, but what a lot of you don't know is that when you click on that link, they send us a check that helps pay for everything. That's the way these websites work, and that's why it's important to click on links. Anyway, on to business as usual. Welcome, Mr. Ed Martin. How are you, sir?
I wouldn't say as usual. I'm tardy often enough, but came close this time. Literally just got off work. So, yeah, everything blew up on us at the last minute today. So that's always exciting.
Well, you can't ask for better than that, man. It's a good way to get your blood pressure pumping and boiling, get you through the rest of the week. Tomorrow's hump day, baby. So I'd rather blow up on Tuesday than Wednesday or Thursday.
Sometimes it never fails that, you know, your first part of your swing shift staff is gone, so you're down to, you know, a skeleton crew. Then in theory, it's just going to load all the pre-assembled shipments onto trucks and stuff, and then all of a sudden, you know, you've got a whole lot more to pre-assemble to deal with. You've got people, as I was explaining to my daughter, we've got people that a lot of people in the world deal with the OSOLA inventory control method as opposed to, you know, first in, first out. So, yeah, we had a bunch of OSOLAs with us today.
Well, I'm glad you shared that news with our listening audience. there's always something going on,
my friend. I figured you were going to ask what OSOLA inventory control method and OSOLA, you know, ordering is.
Actually, no. Actually, no, I don't need to ask that kind of stuff. I don't do anything with that stuff anymore, but I'm slightly familiar with it. You know, and the first-in, first-out mentality and the just-in-time, you know, order delivery stuff, all that crap. And I'm also familiar with the Six Sigma approach, the Jack Welch GE method, you know, that all these companies took over, downsized parts, suppliers. Well, we could spend hours talking about the fallacies of most of that, but we won't. I tell you, and for a lot of you guys, man, I hope you were safe out there today. You know, we're up in the 90s today. I know I was stupid enough to cut my grass today, and I tell you what, I felt every bit of it. I'm not like Martin. I actually have a push mower, and, man, it gets hot when you're pushing that thing. So,
what are you talking about, man? I got a riding mower, I got a push mower, and then I got an old-fashioned human-powered rotary mower.
Wow, dude, I just figured you lived on your riding mower. I didn't even know you owned a push mower anymore. Okay, I learned something today. I did not even know you owned one anymore. All right, but you know what? People don't find out what we use to cut our grass. They tune in and just go to keep up with things that are going on around the world. Real quick update, Paula Deen scandal is going to get even more out of control real quick. You know, we covered that last night. And I have to say this right out of the gate. I have received a bunch of email today, some phone calls and everything else, because I used the N-word on air last night. They think they're going to get an apology. They feel like I owe them an apology. Folks, you can wait till hell freezes over. I'm sorry. If you paid attention to anything we talked about last night, I said the word nigger twice on air to prove a point about the power of words. And I also explained myself in that context as soon as we were done with that in the space of about 2 minutes. I'm not going to apologize for something that was not done to intentionally harm or inflict harm on others. So you guys can forget it. If you're that offended and you're that politically correct, I promise you, you're listening to the wrong radio show. So, you know, I wanted to get that out there, because I tell you what, it was amazing the backlash that you get just trying to prove a point. And it kind of ties into Paula Deen, because the reason we were on that subject last night was because of everything going on with Paula Deen, because she admitted under oath that she had used the N-word. What's really disturbing about the Paula Deen case, though, Ed, and this is where it really continues just kind of growing. Now you've got the Rainbow Push Coalition involved. For those of you who don't know what the Rainbow Push Coalition is, it is the blackmailers in this country. We call Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. They're involved in this stuff. And all they do is try to poison the atmosphere with their own racist brand of flavor so that somebody will pay them just because they open their mouth to say, you're a racist, just to shut them up. So Rainbow Push Coalition is now involved with Paula Deen. Situation. They have an attorney that swears up and down that now they've got all of these other people coming out of the woodwork. You know, that Paula Deen's brother had consistently referred to one black employee as his little monkey. They found evidence of systemic racial discrimination and harassment throughout the whole Paula Deen empire, including Paula Deen, and that these employees were scared to come forward and are still scared to come forward because they fear retaliation. Is this just piling on, Ed? I mean, really, I don't even know what to believe about all of this.
Well, you know, you never know, because it's, you know, definitely if what's been alleged happened, it shouldn't have. But I think, you know, sometimes it's not at all unlike, I think you get the phenomenon like you did with the priest molestations and stuff like that. Yeah, nobody wants to come forward because I could see where it would be intimidating to go up against a multi-millionaire that has a bully pulpit and everything. So once one person comes forward, I'm not going to call it piling on, but, you know, it could be. But it was also, there's always that thing where all of a sudden somebody breaks the silence and more come forward because, you know, like, okay, it's you can survive this. You know, you're not alone. So. You won't know until he goes to court, until he can verify things. But, you know, with things like when organizations that border on extortion networks and stuff, sometimes, you know, they get involved, it does make you question it. But that individuals are coming forward wouldn't surprise me at all. That, you know, once the ice gets broke and they realize they're not alone, they go in too.
Well, actually, I'm totally in agreement with you there to some degree. I, personally, I think there are a lot of employees that do pile on. So I don't want anybody to think, you know, that I'm sitting here making light of that. There are quite a few employees that do pile on. However, when you get into situations like this, these are not generally situations that, you know, are just a single act. There is always more than one act, especially when you deal with somebody like her brother, Bubba Hares, who admitted to doing these things, sexual and racial harassment. You know, the only problem I've got with all of this is, I've got two problems. One, I don't think enough people come forward when you're faced with this kind of thing. So the employees who are coming forward, I really, truly want to commend them. One of the problems I've got with the stories that we do and the people that we out are people are scared to come forward in those situations. So I know how hard a decision that was for them. But really, what I've got a problem with, the Rainbow Push Coalition, the Jacksons, the Sharpton, that kind of garbage. For the record, Rainbow Push is a civil rights group that was founded by Reverend Jesse Jackson Jr. And that is always a red flag to me because this is nothing more than some place to get money. I mean, that's all Jesse Jackson has ever been about. That's all Al Sharpton has ever been about is getting pays just to raise hell. That's going to take away, for me personally, and for a lot of people that stay involved in this kind of stuff, it's going to take away from what's wrong.
Yeah, on the Jackson end of it, absolutely. But actually, Sharpton has come out and made a few statements. You know, it's maybe some people might be overreacting a little bit, you know, and take things in context. But, you know, like I say, all remains to be seen. It's definitely a fluid situation. And, of course, right on the heels of that, I thought you were getting ready to go into the Clarence Thomas thing.
We're actually headed there. I was actually going to save a lot of that for tomorrow night. But,
how about that?
It's
like you always say, I never know where you're going. So, they had a Democrat lawmaker, I'm not sure who, but called, right on the heels of all this, called Clarence Thomas and Uncle Thomas.
Right, exactly.
Where are we going with that?
Well, before we get to the Clarence Thomas deal, I want to point this out, too. In Al Sharpton's defense, I mean, he's made all of his money, his name, and his claim to fame by being a racist himself, in my opinion. But he did speak out on the controversy around Paula Deen. And one thing that he did say, and I've actually got to give him some credit, as hard as that is for me, because I know it's not genuine or sincere, but from the public perspective, Al Sharpton did go out and saying that she should be held accountable only for the acts she committed now, not those acts that she committed 20 years ago, which is what we were talking about last night, was the time she came up in. As a matter of fact, Al Sharpton went on to say that a lot of us have in the past said things we regret saying years ago. And he's obviously one of them, okay? As far as what she's done now is what she needs to be held accountable to, and I actually agree with him in that sentiment. But Paula Deen has lost all kinds of things. Kraft hasn't worked with her in over a year, and they're not going to work with her at all going forward. Smithfield Hams, which is a part of Smithfield Foods Group, they have terminated Paula Deen. QVC, Kmart, they're reviewing their options, but basically she's not going to be on QVC. They've already said that. Kmart's going to end up dropping her too. Of course, the Food Network dropped her show. She's paying a hell of a price for this, and if these are recent things, as it's starting to appear that it is, deservedly so. You know, what she did 20 years ago is what we were pointing out last night. Nobody should have to suffer for that. But, you know, in today's age, if you're doing that stuff today, then you've got a severe problem that needs to be addressed. So, you know, we're going to pay more attention to this going forward, but that's the latest that we have right now. Ed, since you brought up the whole Clarence Thomas thing, let's go ahead and jump into that. It's interesting because Clarence Thomas, as most people know, there was a concurring opinion yesterday put out by Justice Clarence Thomas at the Supreme Court, and it had to do with the University of Texas at Austin's admissions policy. It basically said it was discrimination. And he compared the affirmative action program in this case to slavery and segregation. And he went on to say that the university would have us believe that its discrimination is benign. I think the lesson of history is clear enough. Racial discrimination is never benign. The university's professed good intentions cannot excuse this outright racial discrimination any more than such intentions justify the now denounced arguments of slaveholders and segregations. That was his comment. Now, some people are saying, well, what do you expect? They're going to say that. Well, the deal is this didn't have to do with a black student. The problem was that the University of Texas discriminated against other students to favor a black student to keep this number alive, you know, that everybody has to have. And I thought it was real interesting. Here is Clarence Thomas, who has one of the best law degrees in the world. He graduated from Yale Law School, and he blames Yale Law School's affirmative action program, in his words, for making his degree worth 15 cents. And even with a Yale Law School degree, he still had a problem finding a job after graduation because everybody perceived that he just went in under affirmative action and was a dumb black man. I think that says a lot. Now, you go ahead and go on with your Uncle Tom and everything else, but I wanted to put that out there as well. Your comments, Ed.
Well, I think, you know, granted, there is a perception out there of that. I don't necessarily hire college graduates, so, you know, it's not anything I deal with. But I am, you know, I would have to think at some point, yeah, there are going to be people out there who are going to look at a graduate, you know, whether they got into a prestigious school or not, if they were a minority, you know, somewhere in the back of your mind, you probably think that might have played a role in it. Now, granted, that should pretty easily be swept aside by your grade point averages and any accolades that you earn while you're in college, because, I mean, all that's going to do is get you in. So, you know, if he's going to say his degree was only worth, you know, 15 cents on the dollar, I think that's a little... That's kind of a silly statement because, you know, yeah, if you graduated with a 2.2 average from a very prestigious law school like Yale or Harvard or something like that, and you kind of look at the transcript and think, well, you were a borderline student, weren't you? I would say, yeah, that could cause you some problems. But if you excel, and that's something Oprah Winfrey once said, that the best cure for racism is excellence. So, you know, if he graduated with a high grade point average and other, you know, numerous awards and accolades or whatever, then his statement that it doesn't, you know, the 15 cent statement doesn't work with me.
Well,
graduated
with a
2.2, and it might apply.
And, you know, your Uncle Tom's statement was actually coming from Minnesota state rep. It's interesting because Minnesota state rep Ryan Winkler, you know, called Clarence Thomas and Uncle Tom. But it was actually taken out of context. He actually tweeted something out that said the VRA majority is four accomplices to race discrimination and one Uncle Thomas. He actually meant that in a way, you know, That you know, it's like Uncle Sam. It's actually meant as an endearing term, not a bad term, you know, but everything got blown out of proportion on the Uncle Tom thing. And I just thought that was an interesting contrast to what's going on. But Clarence Thomas has always been controversial for some reason or another. I mean, just because the guy's a black conservative, I guess, they think he's controversial.
Yeah.
But he's pretty damn consistent, you know. But I do like one thing. He wrote in his memoir – and he wrote that I learned the hard way that a law degree from Yale meant one thing for white graduates and another for blacks, no matter how much anyone denied it. I've graduated from one of America's top law schools, but racial preference had robbed my achievement of its true value. And at that time he graduated, he was right. Because everybody said, well, affirmative action has done this. The white man can't get ahead. The black man's just getting a free ride. And that was really the concept through the 80s and a lot of the 90s, to be honest with you. And it still exists today, the mindset does to some degree. But he's absolutely right. When he came up, you know, through school and everything else, he wasn't given credit for what he should have been. Let's go to the phones real quick. 859 number, you're on the air.
Hello, Ed. This is Ken. How are you guys?
Ken Moman, how are you, sir? Folks, this is Ken Moman. He actually hosts the Liberty Unbridled show on Sunday nights right here on the MVM Radio Network. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. I wanted to chime in two things, one on topic and one off. The it's interesting that you talk about Clarence Thomas's experience there about how he got out of college and found that, you know, getting a degree from a prestigious university as a black man meant something different due to affirmative action. And I think that it's those type of things in our young life, those times where you really start to understand and are personally deeply affected by the stupidity of the system, that you kind of go, hey, wait a second. And it's, you know, for me, it was a minimum wage thing, you know, where I worked my butt off, got a raise, and 2 months later, minimum wage went up and wiped out my raise.
Right.
And I was like, what the heck? I worked my butt off to get this raise, and it's gone, you know. And for him, it was, he worked his butt off to get a degree from a prestigious university, and it didn't mean anything.
Right.
And, you know, that's a shame. I mean, the reality is
but
I
that's
mean,
liberal
I
logic.
Really. Yeah, I understand, but and I understand what they're trying to do, but the problem is that, and this is the problem I have with folks to push that kind of stuff, is there's a difference between doing what feels right and doing what is right, and results determine. It's not about intention, it's results. And so what we've seen is that this isn't really a result-based thing, and in fact, if I remember correctly, the U.S. Supreme Court is supposed to be working on a case, I don't know if they've ruled on it or not yet, about race-based admissions in this session. And they're supposed to be determining whether or not that a white student that was denied entry because of their race to a school
to
affirmative action quotas.
This is actually the case. It was a white student at the University of Texas at Austin. It was their admissions policy that was ruled on, and that's why we're talking about Clarence Thomas. It was because of their decision. So that was a catalyst for this. Go ahead.
Well, no, I'm curious. What was the result of that then, real quick? Yes or no? Are we allowed to keep doing that?
No, we're not. As a matter of fact, Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion with that case, and that's why I used him. So, no, they're not going to be allowed to continue that. This is crazy. And they're finding that out. And if you notice, affirmative action is starting to be talked about more and more. You know, we're using Clarence Thomas because the Supreme Court ruled on this today, but you know, affirmative action, a lot of Democrats are finally coming around and saying, hey, this is wrong. You know, you've still got the old school Democrats who are sitting here and using this for nothing more than political favor. I mean, affirmative action does nothing more but tell the black man they're too stupid to go out and do anything to better their lives. And they have spent the last 30 or 40 years trying to force that mindset down. And really, it's insulting and everything else to the black community, continue telling them that they have no worth. I find that atrocious.
Not only,
I really do.
Not only that, the real problem with it is it actually fosters that continued racism with some folks. They say, oh, those black people, they
get
some privileges and all this.
Sure.
It's backfiring. The reality is that exposure to other people that are different from you is what breaks down those barriers. That is what changes people's minds. And I think that that's a good thing for human beings to interact with one another and learn about different experiences. But forcing quotas is not the way to do it. It just harbors more anger. And so the college experience itself, thankfully, we're long past the era of segregated schools for the most part. We'll just leave it at we're past it. The point being that, you know, I think that this is an issue that, you know, they just did the whole thing with the Voting Rights Act yesterday as well, or today, I forget which one. Where they basically said that the criteria for which states are under federal control and have to get everything approved is wiped out now as well. I think we really are at a point where things aren't perfect, and I don't think they're ever going to be perfect, but they're a lot better than they've been, and I think that that's a good thing. And I think that we're reaching the point now where we don't need the quotas. What we need is people just to treat people like individuals, like human beings, and just be done with it.
Well, personally, what I see is the youth movement overcoming a hell of a lot of that built-in prejudice and everything else. Because I don't see the youth making the black-white issue nearly what it was when I was growing up. I mean, I was born in '63, so I came up through the late '60s and all the way through the '70s and stuff, where you still had that racism prominent. Thank God I wasn't raised to be a part of that mindset. You know, I was raised that everybody is equal. If not, I'd probably be the next Paula Deen unwittingly, you know. But I've never looked at that black white paradigm as you're a different skin color than me, so you're either better or worse than I am. You know, I mean, and quite frankly, I've never judged a person's character by the color of their skin. So I was raised that way. A lot of people back in my time weren't. So we've still got a segment of the population that's still young enough to kind of push that on. But with desegregation in schools, black and white are mixing and everything else everywhere, you know, we don't have as much of that dynamic today as we have in the past. So we're definitely moving in the right direction. And but, you know, the question is it time to get rid of affirmative action? Because, I mean, you know, if you listen to what Clarence Thomas wrote in his opinion, and the case was Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin, Clarence Thomas wrote, the slaveholders argued that slavery was a positive good. The civilized blacks elevated them in every dimension of life. And then he went on to say that a century later, segregationists similarly asserted the segregation was not only benign, but good for black students. His point being is they're using the same logic that they used 100 years ago, and it's holding the black man down. And he's right. He's right. You know,
yeah,
it's just basically reverse discrimination.
Well, I think first, you know, one thing we need to look at is the big picture, and you know, and I'm going to brag on Ken a little bit. I'll brag on my own kids a little bit too. But when you score and you are the cream of the crop, it doesn't matter what color you are. It doesn't, you know, like Ken said, is that full ride, is it not, Ken?
Yeah, full ride.
I mean, when you perform and you're at the top, you're at the upper echelon. The schools, it doesn't matter what color you are. They're going to pick you. That's what they want. They want the high nation scores. They want the students that are going to go on and get masters and PhDs, and they'll go on and make a lot of money, become an alumni and a donor and everything. That's what the schools will seek. And it doesn't matter if you got it going on the ball. You don't need affirmative action. And by the same token, if you've got it going on the ball, affirmative action is if you're not a minority, it's not going to apply to you because the schools are going to do everything they can to get the best of the best. All the schools are. So I think one of the things we need to understand about things like affirmative action is that it's catering to and catering against the lower half of the segment. I mean, if you're a top notch student, it doesn't matter what color you are, white, black, Oriental, you're in. The schools want you as a matter, you know, as a matter of money, as a matter of prestige.
Well, yes and no.
If you're somewhere along the bottom, you know, you're kind of borderline. Yeah, you might get nudged out. But yeah, that comes with living on the edge of the admission standards too.
Well, let's be clear here too, though, Ed. I mean, you know, the problem is, I mean, I've been a victim of affirmative action myself personally. You know, through UPS, which is why I left UPS in 1994. You know, I was a victim of affirmative action in 1994. UPS bent their minimum requirements and forced me to sit back and watch two people who had no qualifications to do a job I was supposed to get. And that's a long story we get into another night. But, you know, it is interesting, though, when you look at this, because when you're dealing with the schools and stuff, you know, yes, you're right and you're not right in a sense, and this is what I mean, because every school has minimum requirements for any program. You know, if you're required to have a 2.5 GPA with a certain set of prerequisites to qualify to get into this program, then that's the minimum. If you have a 2.4, you're not getting in. They're not going to bypass those minimum requirements. The difference, I guess, is, though, that you know, what the University of Texas at San Antonio decided to do was, you've got two students side by side, one's white, one's black. That student that may have had a 2.6 and the black student had a 2.5, you know, the white student with a 2.6 should have went in if you based everything on results, but they chose the one with a 2.5. I mean, irrelevant. I mean, they still met the minimum requirements is the point I'm trying to make. So when you get into the school dynamics, you know, sometimes when you're trying to make affirmative action work, you really don't.
You know, and that's something we have to look at. It's like, do you want to be excellent or do you want to be just good enough to get in? Affirmative action comes into play with minimum standards. You want to, if whether you're black or you're white or whatever, you want to, or Oriental or whatever, if you want to put yourself in a position where affirmative action is not a concern, whether it's going to work against you or for you, then quit hovering around the minimums.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. You know, so we've got to start really looking at the big picture here, but that's got a lot to do with it. You know, Ken, I tell you what, you said you had one thing off topic to discuss, and I'm going to let you bring it up in just a second. We're going to take a bottom of the hour break. When we come back, we'll get right back to it. You're listening to the Ed Spencer Show right here on the MVM Radio Network. Stay tuned, folks. A lot more coming at you.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities.
Dial pad to be heard. We appreciate you each and every show. There's always a bunch of guys that listen in the queue, and that just means you're following us around and you like what you're hearing, so we appreciate that. For everybody else that's listening, you can call in at 858-683-1326 or area code 502-805-0334. Okay, Ken, we're back. Ed Martin, of course, is here with us. Ken, you had something you wanted to bring up, and we had to take a break, so talk to me, man.
Yeah, I just wanted to give you guys the news on the special election
the
that
Warmer
happened today.
Won?
Kay actually won.
Yeah, I know.
Amazing.
A 30-year-old lawyer lying about practicing law, has never done anything but intern for a politician, wins an election. Can you believe that?
Yeah, you know, and I don't want to get on too much of a tangent about it, but I do want to mention that he won with less than 50% of the vote. Breakdown, Kay got 44%, Cruz got 34.4%, and Hack got 21.5%, which Hack must have run one heck of a campaign to get 20-something percent when there was $500,000 in that race and almost none of it was his.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty incredible because he only spent, we reported on this last night to gear up for the election today. Between Kay and Cruz, they had already spent about $450,000. They were expected to finish with somewhere around $700,000 to $750,000. So I'll be curious to see how the KREF reports play out and see how much was actually spent. But Hack had only spent $25,000 and got half as much as – I'm sorry. I apologize. Yeah, it was Hack. He had spent about $25,000 and got half as many votes as Kays did. I'm just really puzzled by the thought process in Kentucky. I mean, it's – These guys just like living backwards or something. It's pretty incredible that we outed, and this story first came out by Jake Payne over at the Ville Voice, page one, Kentucky. Give credit where it's due. But they had a debate last Tuesday night, and Kays was caught flat out lying about being a practicing lawyer. He had only done one case on his own, and it had to do with drug charges from a buddy of his. But he was taking credit for working with convicted felons, restoring rights, and all this other crap. He was never an attorney at the time he said he was. He was in law school. So this guy gets caught with major lies, but because he's got a D behind his name, he's going to get elected. I just think that's tragic. I really do. But we were going to get the update on that later tonight, so I'm glad you brought that in now, because the last word I had, there were a couple of precincts left, and Kays was up by like 901 votes. I wasn't sure what the breakdown was.
Ed, I know you're not friends with Jake, but Ken sometimes has less than warm feelings, but you know, this is where you got to quote Jake and say, this is why Kentucky can't have nice things.
Well, I give Jake credit. I didn't take anything away from Jake.
And the thing is, that just boggles my mind is like you said, he's a 30-year-old, no real attorney experience, no real business experience.
Yeah,
gobs of pictures and instances of behaving badly. And what just amazes me is not only that he won, but that in that area that the Democrats, that's what they put up. I'm thinking this kid, and he is a kid, he owes a lot of people a lot of favors. So he's gonna be a reliable vote. I would be stunned if he ever breaks rank with the party leadership.
He won't. He's the next Jack Conway. Yeah, he's the next Jack Conway. He's never done anything relevant in his damn life, but put a D behind his name, and everybody feeds him on a silver platter as long as he gives it back to him. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, I find that very, very insulting. Actually, Ken, I thought you were going to talk about another Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court actually decided on another case, and what they did is they ruled Tuesday that the federal government can no longer force states and jurisdictions with a history of voting discrimination to get federal approval for their voting laws. As everybody knows, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 has basically given the federal government any say they want in everything, from how some states are going to draw their congressional maps to where they place the polling stations. They can decide who can vote, who can't. It's all been up to the federal government, and largely because of all the corruption in voting that was going on in the South. Back in the 50s and 60s. So they came up with the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It was supposed to be just a temporary thing, and they keep extending it. Well, the Supreme Court ruled today and said the Civil War is over, folks. The South just rose again. They have the right to make their own damn rules, and the federal government just has to deal with it. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I mean, I alluded to that break. I mean, I think that that's probably another one of those good things. Time will tell. I mean, I think that I guess it should be both things, right? In some ways, each state having their own set of rules is a nightmare. I mean, running a third party myself, you know, Kentucky's got rules that are unique to any other state. Its set of rules are unique
mm-hmm.
to any other state.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you try to talk to people from other states and get their input, it always is with the caveat, well, we don't do it quite that way in our state. And, I guess in a way from a, you know, local rights, we do what we want to because it's our state kind of perspective, I'm good with it. But at the same time, I certainly can see how it would open the door to more shenanigans. Now, my understanding is the law isn't really struck down per se, but really what we struck down was the mechanism, the what determines whether or not a state is under that guideline? That
well, essentially,
the old guideline
well,
of racial stuff is gone.
Well, essentially, they kept in place some of the stupid stuff, the generic stuff. You know, they kept in place that, you know, like for example, one of the protections that the Voting Rights Act gave us was they had to ban a literacy test. You know, they were actually using a literacy test to determine whether you were allowed to vote or not. That is still in place. But essentially what they did was say, hey, look, we don't have the right to hold the states responsible for something that happened, you know, 40 and 50 years ago. Chief Justice John Roberts actually wrote for the majority, And, you know, and he said that Congress, if it is to divide the states, must identify those jurisdictions to be singled out on a basis that makes sense in light of current conditions. In short, it cannot rely simply on the past, which is what this law has always done, and these guys have always just went ahead and extended it to avoid dealing with the issues that they had to deal with. Now, I've got a little bit of a problem with it, and I tell you what my problem is. As we have found out and continue to find out over the last couple of years, we still have, you know, all kinds of lawsuits and cases going on about illegal voting and everything else. We've already had people found guilty in Hamilton County in Ohio, Cincinnati area, Philadelphia, you know, the northern states that weren't under all of this, right? But we've had all kinds of problems with those guys, you know, illegally voting, getting away with it. And, you know, now that the South is going to be able to make their own laws, and you've got the Democrats who continue to control that, the only concern I've got is, are they going to try to use the Cincinnati and Philadelphia approach to voting, where you bust people in from all over the country, let them vote three or four times and see what sticks? I don't know how that's going to work yet. But I think in the grand scheme of things, it's probably a positive.
I think basically, you know, as I understand it, what it does is if somebody wants to rewrite a precinct or something, they simply just don't have to go through the federal government again. You know, I mean, hell, I don't think that falls. Ken, do you know, does Kentucky fall under that old law?
We did. I know for a fact, actually, we set some court precedent. In 1967 or 68, the state was sued because we didn't redistrict right to follow one man, one vote. And then we were sued again in 72 because we still didn't. We used to do districts by square miles.
What I think it does is it just removes the federal government from it. I mean, what was illegal is still illegal. It's just that they don't have to do mother may I every time they want to change something. Every time, let's say, a new subdivision popped up or you know, a new business park pops up and the population shifts, you need to redistrict. You need to do the one man, one vote, but you got to go through the federal bureaucracy to get it. I mean, if any of the discriminatory practices or if they come, you know, somebody in the South in some of these places that have been freed up from this are stupid enough to go back and try to come up with some Jim Crow-esque law or something that obviously designed to disenfranchise a certain demographic, they're going to get chapped, you know, because it's still illegal. So, you know, it's basically saying, okay, guys, we're going to take the training wheels off, try to keep it between the lines, you know, because they will be watching.
I am personally shocked and outraged at Ken Molman right now to have the audacity dare to suggest that Kentucky would ever have a problem redistricting anything. We haven't had a problem. We've never had a problem. You know, the last 2 years, all the court cases with the redistricting, because our idiots of state government can't figure it out, is not a problem, Ken. And I'm appalled that you would come to that conclusion.
Especially when you hear when lawmakers are sitting there saying, "Oh yeah, I've got a whole bunch of maps on my, you know, that have been proposed. I got one that designed not to have any incumbents run against any other incumbents. I've got others that are make sure that you know, certain Democrats are challenging. You know, they're admitting it. It's like, God, we're the capital of gerrymandering."
Mm-hmm.
Well, my understanding, real quick, on this lawsuit and this case in particular. My understanding is the provision that was basically thrown out, if they hadn't thrown it out, wouldn't have mattered anyway. Because apparently in the 2008 and 2012 elections, this had to do with voter turnout by race, which on its face I kind of reject. I mean, why are we talking about, well, a certain percentage of blacks have to vote, a certain percentage of Hispanics have to vote, a certain percentage of whites have to vote? That's horrible. That shouldn't be it. It should be individual. But beyond that, apparently because of 2008 and 2012, the law was basically going to apply to no one anyway. The threshold was thrown the window.
Well, yes
and
no.
That was what I told, or what I read on the stories that I read about it.
Well, yes and no, because as far as I determine this, we've got another caller on the line we're going to get to in just 1 second. But as far as I determine this, I'm entirely like you, one man, one vote, period. skin color, anything else shouldn't matter. The problem that we have with all the districting and everything else they try to do, they try to do this politically correct crap. You know, if this district ends up predominantly black, then we're going to gerrymander everything so that we can put more white people in, or vice versa. Except, ironically, when you get into Louisville and you start looking at some of these districts, you know, primarily in the West End, you see that you want these districts to remain primarily black because, you know, the politicians go down there and they buy votes. So that's kind of strange in itself. But I don't think it's going to be interpreted that way, Ken. I think there's going to be a lot of changes here forthcoming. With the Supreme Court finally deciding on this, what they basically said was, Congress, do your job and get it right, and we're going to revisit this issue down the road. That's essentially the way that I took it. Let's go back to the phones here. I believe, and I'm sure I'm right, this is Paul with Stop It. How are you, sir?
Hey, gentlemen. Listen, I have to apologize. I'm getting in late on the conversation here, so forgive me if I inadvertently replow some ground, but I have two questions I want to ask your all-star panel that you have on tonight. First of all, this whole Supreme Court decision seems to be focused on southern states. And I wanted to ask this question because I really don't know the answer to this. There have been elements of the Patriot movement that have contended that the southern states have been under a special type of treaty that was created way back at the end of the Civil War back in the 1860s, and that treaty prevails today, and therefore, by treaty, southern states are prevented from doing certain things that northern and western states are allowed to do. Now, I don't know whether that has any validity because I don't know enough about it, but in light of a whole bunch of other things that are beginning to be proven true in the Patriot movement, I think that is an interesting question, okay, especially in light of the Supreme Court decision, all right? The second question I want to append to that is that there are two members of the Libertarian Party on this call tonight, and if I recall correctly, wasn't the Libertarian Party subjected to some type of written agreement with the U.S. government to behave in a certain fashion in order for them not to be prosecuted by the U.S. government? Didn't that happen, or am I remembering that wrong, guys?
Well, I will tell you this. We've got a current libertarian, a great libertarian by the name of Kim Moman on the line with us, and we've got a former libertarian, Mr. Ed Martin. So I'm going to let you guys handle that one. Go ahead.
Well, I can respond to the LP stuff, and as far as I'm aware, there wasn't any formal agreement, you know, early on in the libertarian movement and even through today. Groups that advocate small government and truly believe in small government are often the subject of investigations and infiltration and whatnot because there have been groups in the past that have advocated small government but were violent in the means that they wanted to achieve it, right? They want to... You'll hear people talk about overthrowing the government, and these are your typical militia types. The Libertarian Party resolved that problem, and in part by enforcing what we call the oath of non-initiation of force, which is that we do not advocate the use of violence as a means of achieving social or political goals. And so we kind of just, based on my understanding, the feds just kind of backed off once they realized, hey, these guys are actually just some hippies that are also economic nerds.
Ken, would it be fair for me to say that the Libertarian Party at that particular stage in its life was coerced by the government into adopting that particular item?
You know, I honestly wouldn't be able to tell you. I believe, based on my history, that it occurred before I was born. So I'm not entirely sure. I've only heard this through, you know, the folklore and the spoken history of the party. But my understanding is during the 70s, there was a high bit of interest from the federal government in the party, but that lately they have bigger fish to fry, like people who are actually, you know,
okay,
talking about armed rebellion.
So it remains a possibility that the federal government did coerce the leadership of the Libertarian Party at that time into adopting that kind of an agreement then. It's possible then. Okay.
Well, if not direct, then maybe indirectly, right? As we may have adopted that as a self-defense mechanism, and it is congruent with our philosophy anyway, but by making it explicit, basically saying, look, we're not talking about armed revolt over here, guys, and we're not. But at the same time, today, Department of Homeland Security, you look at the list of things that make you a potential terrorist. And even today, wanting smaller government, believing in that your rights are being taken away from you, these are all things that make you a potential terrorist, according to the Department of Homeland Security.
Okay.
Did that take care? Did that take care of what you wanted?
Well, that again, Ken's got a much, much better understanding of the history of the Libertarian Party than I do. So yes, yeah.
Okay, all right.
How about the Southern States issue?
Well, that one I can't help you with. I wish I could, but I don't know enough about it to tell you about anything like that from the Civil War. I actually haven't went back that far. I've never really had to research that. Now you've given me a project I didn't need. Thank you.
Paul, I can speak to it a little bit. I do know that when there were Northern troops still in, occupying the Southern states after the close of the Civil War, that one of the requirements to be admitted into the Union or readmitted into the Union, also known as to get these troops off your streets, was that they had to sign on to the 13th, 14th, and or was it 12th? No, yeah, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. And I think that that's what these folks were getting that from. I could be wrong, but, you know, there's a lot of folks out there that say that the 13th, 14th, and 15th were illegitimate because the states that signed on to them from the South were basically forced to do so under threat of martial law. Continued martial law, I should say.
Oh, federal
and
coercion
so
again, huh? Okay.
Right. Well, and that's, I think, maybe where they're coming from. I don't know for sure, but I have heard that argument that 13th, 14th, and 15th are illegit because they were basically, the Southern states were forced to get the militias, to get these federal troops off their streets and send them home. But likewise,
okay. There's
things about the 16th Amendment as well, where Ohio tried to rescind the passage of the 16th, and they said you couldn't do that. And I mean, there's always these things. Any major change is not controversy.
Well, essentially, the 15th Amendment says that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race or color. And it gives Congress the power to enforce that command. And essentially what I see, now I don't know how that works into the Civil War, but in 1965, they passed this Voter Rights Act and everything else to try to get rid of the discrimination. And they were initially designed to be temporary. However, Congress has continued, as they do, to push that can down the road. And, you know, they renewed it in 1970, 1975, 1982. They renewed it again in 2006. In 2006, Congress actually extended this for 25 more years just so they didn't have to keep dealing with it because they refused to go in and do their job. And what the Supreme Court basically said was, we're not letting you off the hook. You're going to do your job. Martin, go ahead. We got background noise somewhere.
I think it's Ed.
No, actually, I think it's Paul. Paul, is that you?
Yeah,
I'm going to put you in the queue. I'm going to put Paul back in the queue. We got some background noise. Ed, Martin, go ahead.
Well, guys, I'm actually enjoying just listening to this, but, I think getting back to Paul's first question, everything is congruent with the libertarian mindset, no force. So, to use a word like extortion or forced, no, I don't think the libertarians were forced into it. I think they were probably asked about it, like, what's your position? Upon explaining their position, which is still consistent to this day, they got approval. They didn't have any trouble with the Fed. Just like Ken said, we're not here to do armed takeover. We're not here to force anybody to do things our way. And I think the government was okay with that.
They're
still not okay with the fact that libertarians like smaller government. It's sort of antithetical to the two-party system, but there's not a lot you can do about that.
Right. Well, I can tell you that there are other parties in other states that are not so peaceful. I mean, in doing some research for a completely unrelated issue, I found that in the state of Alaska, in order to become a legitimate political party, you have to submit your bylaws and constitution and principle statement to the Department of Justice, the federal Department of Justice, for approval before the state will approve you as a party. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty hardcore. But, you know, Alaska's had a history of some of those militia-type groups.
Well, that's nothing new. That's nothing new. I tell you what, we're fast running out of time. Ken, thank you so much for the phone call. I do appreciate it. Ed, we're going to get into final thoughts, man. Shoot.
I guess final thoughts, we didn't touch on it too much, but the election that just went down and the amount of money that was spent on this election and who we ended up with. I'm going to have to chew over those numbers and see what happened. Because I know this year was out, you know, the Democrats were out in force stumping for this kid. I don't really recall much of anything as far as policy that I read about what he stood for that was impressive. You know, anything that make you go, hey. So, you know, hey, it was a Democrat seat to begin with. It's a Democrat seat now, so not a lot's changed. It's just a whole bunch of advertisers made a whole lot of money. A whole bunch of special interests wagered a lot of money. One group of special interests obviously won. So I think when you get a weak candidate like that, I think when you get a candidate that's, you know, whose street creds are not what they should be, you know, we've got a yes man. So, you know, the guys in the 56, the voters in the 56, congratulations, you got a yes man. You might as well have elected Greg Stumbo and Steve Beshear to be your representative, because this guy is not going to, he is not going to color outside of the lines. And when you got a state with a pension as screwed up as ours, state with, they can't do their constitutional duty and redistrict like ours, you got a state that's got all the problems we've got, the bureaucracy, the roads, you name it, any, you know, all the crony politics that goes on. Congratulations, 56. You elected a yes man.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I have to agree with you. I really hope that I'm proven wrong. More than anything, I hope that I'm proven wrong. But unfortunately, experience tells us that when you take somebody with no experience who is willing to lie in the very first race to get a job that they're not qualified for, that ought to tell you a lot about expectations. In this particular case, I think that the people of Kentucky will be better served by, you know, I don't know, maybe going to the Louisville Zoo and hiring a giraffe to represent that district, because this guy is nothing more than a yes man, in my opinion. He looks to me to be the Jack Conway light. Jack Conway at least has some charisma. This guy doesn't appear to even have that. So that's something to look forward to. Monday, August the 5th, I want you guys to put this on your calendar. Dads of Kentuckiana, DAD stands for Dads Appreciating Down Syndrome. They work with special needs kids with Down syndrome and a whole host of other things. But Dads of Kentuckiana is having their annual golf scramble on Monday, August the 5th. Registration, it will open up 11 o'clock that morning. For you guys who want info on this, you know, you can go to dadsofkentuckiana.org. You know, looking for hole sponsors or looking for silent auction items. These guys do great work. This is one of their biggest events. There'll be door prizes, dinner, mention silent auction, things like that. But go to dadsofkentuckiana.org, or you can call Bart Atkins at 445-3103. That's area code 502-445-3103. The scramble will be at Quail Chase Golf Club. But if you guys get a chance, really, truly, get a hold of these guys and join that scramble. Tomorrow night, we will get into, man, a little bit of this IRS stuff. We're going to get into the national stuff. You know, if you remember Ed Martin, they told us that this whole IRS scandal was because of two people in Cincinnati, two rogue employees. Now we find out that that was a lie, like we didn't know that in the first place. But now we know that there's at least 12 different departments around the country, including Washington, D.C., where the IRS was recklessly doing this. I also want to talk about, if we can, a little bit more on the Benghazi scandal that's coming about. We're going to give you updates on Edward Snowden, who did not leave Russia today like everybody thought he was. And we really want to mention a story that we haven't mentioned yet, Michael Hastings. The Rolling Stone. This was a journalist for the Rolling Stone. He's the one that's been credited with bringing down General Stanley McChrystal. You know, died in a car accident, you know, in Los Angeles. 3 hours after he was ready to put something else out there. coincidence? For you conspiracy theorists, we'll talk about it tomorrow night and find out. So we'll get into a lot of these stories and more tomorrow night. Don't forget to be here at 7 o'clock. Mr. Martin, we appreciate it as always. We'll see you next week.
All right.
Thanks so much to Ken Molman. And don't forget to check out his show Sunday nights right here on the MVM Radio Network at 7 o'clock with Liberty Unbridled. And, of course, thanks to Paul Holliger with the Stop It organization for chiming in on the voting stuff. We'll see you guys later. Have a great night. Thanks again. Take care.